Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, folks. This is the Cure Panel, and we had a little bit of a technical delay to get the call and the panel started. This is Sharib here, filling in for Priya, whose call got dropped as the panel was starting. We have Gary Peterson as our co-host, and we have Dr. Anil Patri as our expert today. And we'll basically go with Dr. Patri giving a little bit background about his work at the NCI, and we'll have Gary.
Come back.
Oh, this is good. Have Priya back so we can get her back.
Yeah. Thank you so much, Sharib. Sorry, I think I just lost my call there. Good evening, everyone, and welcome to the Cure Panel Talk Show. Sharib must have told you, we are I'm Priya Menon, scientific media editor, Cure Talk. And along with the Cure Talk team of Sharib Khan, who just spoke to you, and Chintan Patel, I welcome all of you this evening for a discussion on nanotechnology in oncology. As always, we will be moderating the call and bringing people live on the show. The Cure Panel Talk Show is organized by Cure Talk, the blog of TrialX.com, an online platform to connect patients to clinical trials of new treatments. For information on clinical trials for all conditions, please visit TrialX.com/ask. This is the 15th episode of the Cure Panel Talk Show, and we are excited to announce that we'll be turning one in August. We have quite a few interesting shows lined up for you for the rest of the month. Later in the week, we'll be discussing yoga for trauma with David Emerson from Justice Resource Institute. The monthly panel discussion on multiple myeloma will feature Major League Baseball coach Don Baylor and eminent myeloma expert Dr. James Berenson from Institute of Myeloma and Bone Cancer Research. Our live on-air Myeloma Support Group meeting will be conducted on June 27th at 6 p.m. Eastern Time. Today, we are discussing nanotechnology in oncology. Before we begin, I would like to mention that towards the end of the discussion, we would be taking questions from callers. They can let us know by pressing 1 on their keypads, and we will bring them online live. Now, it is a great pleasure and honor that I welcome Dr. Anil K. Patri, Deputy Director at Nanotechnology Characterization Laboratory at the National Cancer Institute, Frederick. At NCL, Dr. Patri heads a team of scientists from multidisciplinary fields who are working together to facilitate the development of nanomaterials intended for clinical use. Dr. Patri is involved in physicochemical characterization and standardization of nanomaterials for the NCL and collaborates with scientists at the NIST and FDA. Welcome to the show, Dr. Patri. Today's show is co-hosted by Gary Peterson, who is editor of MyelomaSurvival.com. He works with myeloma specialists to provide life expectancy and survival rate data through his site. Welcome, Gary. On the panel, we have noted myeloma author, blogger, and survivor Pat Killingsworth. Pat was diagnosed with multiple myeloma in April 2007. Pat is author of 4 myeloma books, and he has maintains two blogs, Living with Multiple Myeloma and Help with Cancer. In addition, on the panel, we have Kimberly Blossey. Ms. Blossey is a senior clinical research professional and entrepreneur. She was manager of clinical research at Columbia University's Herbert Irving Comprehensive Cancer Center. Welcome to the show, Kim. And there we have a student expert with us today, Sarthak Sinha, who is a student at Henry Wisewood High School in Calgary, Alberta. Sarthak has been working the past 2 years doing graduate-level research in Jeff Bernsky's Experimental Medicine and Stem Cell Biology Lab, University of Calgary. He has represented Canada and contributed towards field of medicine in many an international competition. I welcome all the panelists to the show. Before I hand over to Gary, please remember, we will be taking in calls at the end of the discussion. People who have called in can press 1 on the keypads, and we'll bring them online to answer questions to the panel. Gary, it's all yours. You're on air live.
Well, and happy birthday, you one-year-old, you.
Thank you.
And first and foremost, I want to acknowledge all the participants, patients, caregivers, and the panel members that have chosen to join us in this discussion of nanotechnology and oncology. And, of course, I'd like to personally thank the folks from CureTalk for providing us with this forum, and it's been so crucial, I think, for a lot of people. One of the things that I had found originally is that nanotechnology seems to have a great place in science fiction TV with shows like Revolution. But I feel that now, after some 8 years, that the program that was started by the National Cancer Institute with a $150 million grant was to develop nanotechnology for the use in cancer treatments. Now, as we all know, as cancer patients, or some of us who are cancer patients, know that from the time it becomes an idea or a clinical test to the time it becomes a drug that's FDA approved takes some 10 years. Now, the National Comprehensive Cancer Center that the doctor is the assistant director of, it happens to have started in 2005 with this $150 million budget from the government. This is something that I feel is important because with multiple myeloma and a lot of blood cancers, as well as any stage 4 or metastasized cancer, it's all over your body, and as a result, you need something that's either like an immunotherapy or another targeted approach. And what I see here is that this is a potentially targeted approach that delivers more drugs to where it is intended, and that is the cancer cell. This, I think, is critical in all these other cancers, especially in a stage 4 cancer, any stage 4 cancer, because now the cancer has gone further away from its original site, and you need to have a targeted therapy. Now, given that preface, I'd like to say that we are honored to have Dr. Anil Petri here, who is not only the deputy director of the Nanotechnology Characteristics Lab, which is, I think, the largest lab from this $150 million that was originally acquired, but also has done a heck of a lot of work in this area at the University of Michigan and also at the University of South Florida. I am honored to have the doctor, Dr. Petri, discuss nanotechnology and oncology. And doctor, welcome, and thank you very much for your time and your efforts.
You may... Thanks, Gary. Can you hear me? Thanks, Gary.
We're loud and clear.
Yeah, for the kind invitation and introduction. It is my pleasure to participate in the CURE panel talk show along with other panelists. To share and discuss about the latest developments in nanotechnology for cancer. Gary, I should you mentioned that this $150 million program is for NCL. It is actually a NCI-wide Alliance for Nanotechnology, and so most of that funding is to the Centers of Cancer Nanotechnology Excellence that went out, but nevertheless, our lab is interested in the clinical translation of promising cancer nanotechnology drugs and imaging agents, and I'm going to talk briefly about our lab towards the end. So let me first start by defining what we mean by nanotechnology. Probably people heard of nano before, but the NNI has a very good definition, the National Nanotechnology Initiative. So nanotechnology is understanding and control of matter at the nanoscale. This is roughly in the range of 1 to 100 nanometers, where unique phenomena enable novel applications. So in other words, just a material being in that size range does not may or may not have unique properties. So some material, because of that size range, have some unique properties. Again, for the benefit of listeners, nanometer is a measurement unit, which is a billionth of a meter. For example, in a biological world, our DNA is around 2.5 nanometers in diameter. We hear about antibodies, and antibodies around 13 to 15 nanometers in size. So most of our proteins, enzymes, and other natural biological components are at this size range, and function is at this nanoscale. So again, there are many different kinds of nanomaterial. Some are from the colloidal world that are there for a long time. Polymers are also now can be self-assembled and called nanomaterial. Liposomes are also nano because of their size range and some unique properties because of their size and surface characteristics. And there are many others that are relatively new based on new technologies, new coatings, new core shell nanoparticles. So most of the nanotechnology development is in medicine is in oncology. So if you look at all the nanotechnology in medicine, I would say around 80% of those medical applications are in oncology area. Early detection of cancer is a challenge, as you all know. But once a patient is diagnosed, there are only limited options available to patients. So surgery, radiation therapy, and chemotherapy are the most common treatment options, depending on the type and the staging of cancer. With nanomaterials, the options are much better. For example, for early disease detection, imaging of the disease, new materials are being developed to aid in the surgery, and better chemotherapy using nanomaterial platforms for targeted drug delivery, as Gary mentioned before. So I will briefly touch upon each of these topics. So we have made significant advances in the preclinical development with nanomaterial-based vaccines for prevention of cancer. Many different kinds of nanoscale material-based devices are in development that can detect cancer biomarkers at very low concentrations in biological fluids. This means we can detect the cancer early. Again, early detection is a key for a better outcome. Detection of different biomarkers simultaneously. Again, this can aid in the future in the personalized medicine area. And those kinds of concepts are in the research and development phase of development. Another very active area of research for over two decades now is the development of in vivo imaging modalities using nanomaterial. Due to the extended blood circulation based on size and surface characteristics of nanomaterial, if an imaging agent is tagged to these nanomaterial, one can image areas in the body that are otherwise not visible using conventional imaging techniques. Many blood pool agents and lymphatic imaging agents are in development and will aid in the detection and confirmation of cancer. Then there are these new concepts to assist in surgery for surgeons. So these are color dyes or fluorescent markers that are tagged with the nanomaterial, and they can be sprayed during surgery. And this will aid the surgeon defining the tumor border. Sometimes, they can see the residual nodules that are otherwise left in the patient, and again, cancer can come back if such a thing happens. So these are in preclinical development, and then hopefully we'll see them, some of these in the surgical realm pretty soon. So predominantly when I say nano for cancer, these are mostly the concepts involve the drug delivery. And this is where our lab has done a lot of work working with more than 100 different kinds of concepts in the preclinical assessment. So there are many different kinds of nanomaterial, as I mentioned, including liposomes, emulsion, dendrimers, polymers, metals, metal oxides, nanoparticle. They have unique features that one can use for cancer. So in general, they reduce the toxicity associated with chemotherapy while increasing the efficacy of the chemotherapeutic. There are many other concepts that use gene delivery, and they are also in the preclinical development, advanced stages of preclinical development. There are some that are very unique that are in clinical trials. These are core shell nanoparticles, such as these gold nanoshells containing silica core gold shell, and they have unique absorption range that can be tuned based on the size and the shell thickness. So one of these concepts actually is in clinical trials, phase one clinical trials for thermal ablation of tumors. Cancer is a very complex disease, and we know that the tumors at the primary site is different from the metastatic sites. So medicines that work on a certain tumor type do not necessarily take care of the other disease sites. So again, this is where nanotechnology is useful. One can have multiple drugs in the same nanomaterial platform to address and then deliver chemotherapy to the tumor site. And finally, a small, I guess, few sentences about our lab, the nanotechnology lab, is a part of the National Cancer Institute. It is a centralized core facility, if you will, and we conduct a preclinical assessment of nanomaterial concepts that are beyond proof of principle efficacy. In other words, we start with the concepts where people show efficacy in a mouse model to cure cancer in mice, if you will. So we collaborate with many industrial partners, academic and government agencies to enable clinical translation of promising and safer cancer therapeutics and imaging agents. So in other words, our work, you know, really is in the translational side. We don't conduct basic research for most part, but really our focus is clinical translation to aid companies. So we have close collaborations with Food and Drug Administration, and we also have a collaboration with the National Institute of Standards and Technology in this clinical translational effort. So we conduct, in this effort, we conduct thorough material characterization, biological assessment in cell cultures and human blood, biocompatibility experiments, and we also conduct in vivo studies in rodent models, both the rats and mice. So with that, I'll stop here with the introduction of nanotechnology in cancer, and I'll be happy to discuss these further with the rest of the panel.
Okay, I know that Priya has a few questions. Do you want to ask one of those to begin with, Priya? And I'll rotate you in.
Gary, I think you can start with your questions.
Okay.
I'll mine to the end. Yeah.
All right. Doctor, one thing that I noticed, and as I was reading through some of the information on nanotechnology, is that there's a technology called stealth, and that technology was used with doxorubicin, mm-hmm. which is an old line chemotherapy for, I believe it was used in VAD way back when, but it wasn't very effective, and that once the stealth technology, which is a nanotechnology, was used with or doxorubicin, that it became a new drug called Doxil. And Doxil has shown far improved efficacy without the problems that they used to have with heart issues, actually. And what it shows is that far more of this drug seems to get to, far more of this drug, which really didn't used to be very effective, is now getting to the cancer cells, and as a result is far more effective. And as shown in a number of clinical trials, being actually quite good in refractory and resistant multiple myeloma or high-risk multiple myeloma, which is something that nothing really has in the past been able to be very effective other than our standard therapy, our big gun, and our big gun in myeloma happens to be Revlimid, Velcade, and dexamethasone. Mm-hmm. So my question is that this stealth technology works so well with Doxil, you know, why on earth isn't it, you know, combined with Revlimid, Doxil, Velcade, and Dex in a little myeloma atomic bomb and just wipe that stuff out? What, you know, why isn't that technology there today?
Again, Gary, this is a very good example of how nanotechnology works. So you mentioned that the doxorubicin, which is a small molecule drug, has cardiotoxicity problems. And usually most of the small molecule chemotherapeutics, when they are injected, they have a very quick blood circulation. They are very cleared very quickly. These are hydrophobic drugs. And less than 1%, in most cases, less than 0.1% of the injected dose goes to the tumor. So you're essentially wasting more than 99% of the drug. It goes elsewhere and then causes toxicity. So what these people have done, actually it was developed originally by Frank Zocca and his colleagues at UCSF. And so they prepared a liposome, which is around 100 nanometers in size, and they coated with polyethylene glycol, which gives this stealth property, meaning that once it is injected into the bloodstream, our immune system recognizes anything that is foreign. So once if you coat the particles, in this case liposomes, with polyethylene glycol, then they escape the immune system recognition, or it's also called reticuloendothelial system recognition. So then if the immune system is not recognizing the particle, then the particles will have prolonged blood circulation. They stay in the blood for extended period of time, and so extended half-life, or extended blood half-life it is called. Or PK changes, the pharmacokinetics of the drug changes. So along with that, because of the size and surface characteristics, because of the biodistribution being different, it gets away, or the cardiotoxicity associated with the doxorubicin is minimized. So once it is encapsulated, or once it is packed inside this liposome, now doxorubicin behaves as a liposome and not as a doxorubicin initially until it is released. So this combination, this is a common feature of most of the nanomedicines or nanotechnology for cancer. So you're masking the drug from immune system recognition, and through, there are certain concepts such as enhanced permeability and retention, or this is also called EPR, where you can localize the drug at the tumor site better than if you have a small molecule drug with the CPR phenomenon. Then so you have limited side effects. So that is how it is developed. But your main question about the combination with other chemotherapeutics, it is entirely possible. I'm not aware, but that doesn't mean that these are not happening in the clinic.
So would it work the same way for like Revlimid, which is like a thalidomide, dexamethasone, which I'm sure you're familiar with, and
right. And so they can be encapsulated in the liposome, or they can be encapsulated in a different liposome, and then can be given as a combination of Doxil and the liposome encapsulated other drugs. So it is possible.
What prevents this from being done? Is it? I know Doxil, long ago has run out of patent protection, but Revlimid and Velcade are probably well protected still yet. Does that have anything to do with it?
No, so if there is patent protection, those are patent issues, but there are a lot of liposomes in development. For example, paclitaxel is packed into liposomes. This is something in, I think, in phase one clinical trials. There are many dozens of different liposomal formulations packing different kinds of drugs that are in the clinical phase of development.
Okay, it'd just be nice to see it speeding along. Okay, Pat Killingsworth, your question.
Hi, Gary. Hello, doctor.
Hello, Pat.
So maybe I was, my initial question was correct, that I was going to ask you. It read, how does nanotechnology translate from research to actual therapy? And I think about little mini submarines swimming around zapping cancer cells. I think that's what we thought about originally when we would hear that term. And listening to you, and I did a little research, it sounds like, is it more of a delivery system? So maybe it's not, that's not so far off. Are we talking about a new type of drug or compound, or is this basically how you're going to deliver existing chemotherapy or the type of drug that researchers are working on?
Yeah, that's a very good question. So it is both. So many of them are these packing kind of platforms where whether it is polymer-based platform or a liposome or an emulsion, any of these are traditionally, they are not called nano before, but because of the size and function, they became nanomaterial these days. So many of them do use that kind of packing and escape the immune system recognition. Sometimes, in some cases, you want the immune system to recognize. This is a case for vaccines. So you can coat particles in such a way that certain components of the body recognize this material. In some cases, the composition itself is recognized by the body. For example, if you have phosphorus-containing material, depending on the composition, the body recognizes them in a certain way and localizes them to certain organs or certain parts of the body. So in those cases, you are using the strength of the composition of the material and send the drug to the site of action. In other cases, if you know, for example, in case of targeted therapies, these nanomaterial can be functionalized with the targeting ligands on the surface, such as antibodies or fraction or portions of the antibodies, peptides, and small molecules, to bind to tumor overexpressed receptors on the tumor, and that way they localize to the tumor site, and so thereby delivering more drug to the tumor site than if you just have a small molecule based therapy. So to answer your question, it is both as a carrier platform as well as based on composition and targeting modality. You can enhance the delivery of the drug.
So at last year's ASCO, the blockbuster, you know how there's a blockbuster or two that the media picks up on every year. Mm-hmm. That was a combination cancer therapy using a delivery system that allowed the chemotherapy to not be released until the actual cell was located. And it sounds like that's a perfect example. And I'm sorry, I don't remember the name of the drug. Maybe you know it, but that sounds like the perfect example of what you're talking about with nanotechnology. Are you familiar with that one?
No, I don't know exactly which one that you're talking about, but generally that is true. The advantage with nanomaterial is that you can have these are called multifunctional nanomaterials. So on the same particle, you can have a targeting ligand, You can have a therapeutic payload, one or more combinations, concoctions of drugs, and as well as, for example, an imaging agent to see where these therapies are going. So these are all multifunctional platforms, and in fact, NCI funded these programs in the late 1990s. It's called Unconventional Innovations Program. So the next phase of the program is the Alliance for Nanotechnology in Cancer in 2004. Yes, these are all the targeted delivery. So instead of 1% of the injected dose, if we can increase it to 10%, that is an order of magnitude more that is being delivered to the cancer, and then we'll have much better outcome.
Sure, and theoretically, you could use a lower dose if it's more efficient, correct?
Exactly. Mm-hmm. So far, what we have seen in the preclinical area is that you could actually deliver more drug, and you're right. Ideally, if you could get away with using less drug, you will have less side effects.
Wonderful. Thank you.
Very good. Thank you, Pat. Kimberly?
Hi, yes, can you hear me?
Yes.
Yeah.
Great. Well, hi, everyone. Thanks for having me on the CURE panel. And hello, Dr. Patry. It's a pleasure to speak with you. My question for you is, so I worked in cancer research for many years, and at the tail end of my stay at Columbia University, we did begin to get into some drug delivery kind of nanotechnology-based systems. But I was always questioning why the kind of drug delivery systems were only targeting kind of either the cancer cells or maybe some kind of signaling cascade with proteins or, you know, some essential nutrient to the cancer. But we have never, or it seems like, at least I didn't know about, any research that was targeting the genes of the cancer, the actual genetics inside of our genomes that make a cell cancerous or not. And I'd love to hear from you, you know, what the limitations have been. Is there being research done on that? Just any comments you can make on that would be great to hear about.
Yeah, in terms of gene delivery, so beyond drug delivery, there are many concepts that are in preclinical development, I should say, for gene delivery. So, for example, saRNA is something that a lot of people are interested in delivering to cancer. And so if you were to just inject saRNA, then it's immediately cleared. And then so using nano materials, so most of them use some kind of cationic nanoparticle and attach or bind these saRNA to the nanoparticles and then inject. So most of that work is done in an in vitro system. In other words, in a cell culture system that works great. But once you get into the in vivo system, or into the animal models, mm-hmm. then the complexities are a lot more difficult to overcome. But certainly there are many saRNA delivery systems. Different kinds of platforms use saRNA, and we have seen some promise in the preclinical area, and then I'm sure some of these end up in the clinical phase pretty soon. There are some others who take these genes ex vivo, in other words, retrain our immune system and then let our immune system take care of cancer. So this is going to be the best outcome for cancer patients from my perspective, because most of us are, I should say all of us have cancer. It's just that our immune system takes care of the cancer. It's only when the immune system fails and one cell becomes cancerous and eventually years down the road that becomes a tumor from my in cancer biology. So if we can retrain our immune system using nano, which some hospitals are trying to do, and then re-inject those therapies, I think that will be the best outcome for patients down the road.
Great. And just a quick follow-up on that, what I heard you say in the beginning is that it seems like we've gotten pretty good at targeting the sections of the RNA we need to deliver to the genome to shut on or off different cancer genes. It's just once it gets introduced into the body of a living creature, that's when all the complexities and difficulties set in. Did I get that right?
Yes. So in an in vitro system, it is a more controlled system. It is easy to have a proof of principle. But once you inject into an animal, for example, then you have more complexities because of all the different kinds of cells and proteins that try to tear these particles apart.
Okay, got it. Great, thank you.
All right, Sartek?
Yep.
Your question?
All right. So, Dr. Patrick, my name is Sartek. I'm a grade 11 student here in Calgary. One of my questions was the use of nanotechnology in relation to heat shock therapy. I would really appreciate if you could go in a little bit detail of that. So how we're trying to attempt at that, and where we are, sir, in developing heat therapy.
So if you're asking about the thermal ablation therapy, is that your question?
Yep.
Okay. Because there are heat shock proteins, and I hope it's not the one that you're talking about. So in the case of thermal ablation, again, this is a uniqueness of nanotechnology. If you take a gold salt, it behaves a certain way, and if you make it into a gold nanoparticle, it has absorption around 500 nanometers or so. And it has absorption in that range. But if the same gold nanoparticle, if you make it into a rod shape instead of a spherical particle, if you just make it into a rod, then the absorption shifts. So depending on how long the rod is, then the wavelength of absorption shifts. So you can actually modulate that, synthesizing different shapes of these particles. In terms of thermal ablation, so you can go with an external energy source away from the rest of the body absorption range. This is called a water window. So you can take these particles around 800 nanometers absorption. So they absorb this energy and give out heat. And that's when, if they are near the cancer cells or inside the cancer cells, then you can kill the cancer cells specifically without harming the rest of the normal cells. So there's one concept, but then the concept that is actually in clinical trials, it is in phase one clinical trials work out of Rice University, is a core shell particle. This is a silica core gold shell nanoparticle. And then they coat these with polyethylene glycol to escape the immune system we talked about before, and localize these therapies at around 150 nanometers in size into cancer, and then go with an external energy and then ablate the tumor. And one limitation there is the depth of penetration of these lasers that they use, and they cannot penetrate. So they can use this kind of therapy only in limited cases where they can actually have an access.
Okay. Another one of my questions was: are these dendrimer-based nanoparticles, are they degradable once they go in vivo, or do they leave some potential after effects?
Yeah. So dendrimers are by in a general layman terms, these are like polymers. These are organic polymer systems. So you can make literally a branched molecule out of a bifunctional molecule. And so there are literally thousands and thousands of different kinds of dendrimers. There are only a few that are commercially available that are for example, PAM-AM dendrimers or polyamidoamine dendrimers or polypropylene imine dendrimers. But they can be made biodegradable. They are these biodendrimers that are actually biodegradable. So you can make them biodegradable. You can have You can synthesize them in a very uniform fashion because it is just like any other organic synthesis. And for most part, they are eliminated from the system. Some, based on the size, if they are less than 10 nanometers in size, for example, they are quickly eliminated through the kidney and eliminated from the system. If they are larger than 10 nanometers, then they may go through a liver excretion process, but they are eventually excreted. And some are actually biodegradable. So they are an excellent platform for drug delivery.
Okay. And, you know, in terms of drug delivery,
Yes, that's we need to go on to the next question.
Oh, yeah, of course. By all means.
Okay. All right, doctor, on the, you know, talking of drug delivery as well, you also have a breast cancer drug that just was recently approved called Abraxane, I believe.
Mm-hmm.
And I was wondering if this same technology, just talking about chemotherapy drugs like Revlimid, Velcade, and Krypolis, I believe is another one, can that particular delivery technology also be used for these other drugs?
Yeah, it is certainly possible.
Combination with the stealth technology.
Yeah, so unlike the doxorubicin encapsulated liposome, the doxyl, which is a stealth nanoparticle, it has a prolonged half-life in the blood. Abraxane is a formulation of human serum albumin with the paclitaxel, which is a drug. So paclitaxel is also delivered with a cremophore. It's called Taxol, and that's also used.
But effective, right, is that Abraxane?
So Abraxane is a paclitaxel. The active drug is paclitaxel, and it is packed in with the human serum albumin. So the main difference between Taxol and Abraxane is that you don't have cremophore-related toxicity with Abraxane. So cremophore is essentially, these are formulations, so to make these small molecules soluble, they use oils and things like that, and they can be toxic. And that's what happens. You have more toxicity from the formulation, not necessarily from the drug with the cremophore formulation. It's called Taxol compared to Abraxane, which just uses human albumin, which we have anyway, and then delivers the drug. But there is no real drug delivery. You're just getting away from the toxicities associated with cremophore. And in case of Abraxane, once it is injected, it really falls apart quickly. It is meant to fall apart quickly and deliver or release the drug into the bloodstream. So your question of whether you can use the same technology to formulate other drugs, it is certainly possible.
One of the things that I noticed when I had read about it is that apparently this coating, this nanotechnology coating that puts on it, is the cancer cells, which apparently love to eat things, you know, I mean, it's got that insatiable appetite, that considers it food. And as a result, it kind of, it targets the cancer cell. Did I read that incorrectly?
Yes, there are some, these are still in clinical, they're looking at this in the clinic or from the clinical data that such a thing is possible. But for most part, Abraxane has a human serum albumin, and we have, in our bloodstream, we have this albumin, tons of albumin in our bloodstream. So once it is injected, it quickly falls apart and releases a drug. So whether it gets accumulated, we don't see, at least in the preclinical stages, we don't see any significant difference in the pharmacokinetics of the drug, because the drug falls apart very quickly.
Okay.
And so unless it is intact with the protein-bound drug and somehow circulates, maybe there is certain portion of the drug that gets circulated that way and then have better efficacy. but for most part, it is free in the bloodstream.
Okay, and follow up also to my last question, and it has to do with that stealth technology. In 2006, researchers at UC San Francisco and UC Berkeley had found a way to combine, I think it was doxorubicin, with a detrimer to give a treatment that cures colon cancer in mice in one treatment. And this was given as a possible cure for colon cancer. Has this progressed to human trial, or how long till FDA approval?
So this
just doesn't translate from mice to people.
So we are, at least I'm intimately familiar with this work, because this is an excellent, beautiful work done by my friends Frank Zocca from UCSF and Jean Frechet, who is another dendrimer professor in California. But this has never gone into clinic. So in this case, they use a degradable polyester dendrimer. That's an earlier question about dendrimer degradability. And they conjugated doxorubicin, and they had a remarkable anti-tumor efficacy upon single-dose IV administration. But this is similar to liposomal doxorubicin, which is Doxil. So they had remarkable efficacy, but that efficacy is similar to existing approved drug, Doxil. And so Doxil is incidentally developed by Frank Zocca, the Doxil formulation, and which eventually came to the market through Johnson & Johnson. So as far as I know, this concept has never been pursued to get into clinic. There may be multiple reasons for that, complications with the complexity of the bow tie dendrimer with the chemistry, but it has a similar efficacy compared to an approved drug. So when commercially, you have to show advantage over existing therapies, and that's where we usually start, is beyond a proof of principle. And most of them may not get into the clinic because of that.
Okay, well, thank you so much, Doctor. At this point, Priya, would you like to bring on some of the callers? We've got about 12 minutes.
Sure, Gary. Callers who have a question for our panel, may please press 1 on your keypad, and that let us know that you want to ask a question, and we'll bring you live on air. Callers can press 1, and we'll bring you live on air to ask your question. Gary, while we wait for the callers, we can proceed with the discussion.
Okay.
I'll let you know when somebody comes on. Yeah.
Okay. I have got a question from one of the participants, and it says, what treatments are in the works for stage 4 colon cancer? What clinical trials are now in development for solid tumors like colon cancer?
I am not really qualified, because I'm not an oncologist, to talk about this, but certainly they can go to the website. There is a website called clinicaltrials.gov, www.clinicaltrials.gov, and type in colon cancer. So there are literally many dozens of clinical trials for different stages of colon cancer, and they can easily find that information on the website.
Okay. I've got anybody online yet, Priya?
Gary, if I may, Dr. Badri, I have a question for you. What are the negative implications of nanotechnology with reference to cancer?
So that's a good question. So whenever we talk about nanotechnology, there is this question that comes up about the health implications of nanomaterial, environmental implications of nano. So particularly for cancer, the ones that we went through in the preclinical assessment, there is no significant limitation, because most of the toxicity is coming from the chemotherapy that is encapsulated. And all the material that we have seen at the doses that we administered were less toxic than chemotherapies. So, for example, there is concern over potential toxicity of carbon nanotubes. But these are all, one has to look at in terms of benefit to cancer patients. So it is a risk versus benefit. So when one goes to FDA, as we all know, no material is safe. It is just it just depends on the dose. And then so the risk versus benefit, actually you have much better benefit with the nanomaterial than the risk, especially for cancer. That's the reason most of the concepts, I would say 80% of the medicine involved with nanomaterial is for cancer.
Dr. Ha, when I was just reading up about nanotechnology while planning this panel, I came up about a lot of issues regarding people being concerned about accumulating nanoparticles in our healthy body tissues. How true is this?
Yeah, that's a very good question. It is true that some of the metal-containing nanoparticles, such as gold or others, do stay in the body for a longer period of time. In other words, your body's immune system eventually recognizes and then takes these nanoparticles either to the liver or spleen, and these particles may stay there for an extended period of time. But many others, the platforms that we talked about today, including dendrimers, liposomes, and emulsions, these are all organic material, and they are either biodegradable or eliminatable from the body. So I would say, yes, depending on the composition, they may stay in the body for an extended period of time.
Thank you, Doctor. Kim, would you like to ask a question to Dr. Patchy?
Yeah, sure. I have a bit of a comical question, but also slightly real in my mind anyways as well. So I read a lot of science fiction. I also write science fiction. And, of course, there's these pictures of little robots being injected into the bloodstream with little scrubbing brushes and arms that clean different things away from blood vessels or, you know, remove cancer cells, things like that. But I currently work in an imaging group called Nanotronics Imaging, and we make an automated microscope, and it looks at mainly semiconductors, but we're getting into the life sciences. But I bring that all up because semiconductors and also related MEMS devices are getting into the nano level of being able to store information and data. But also, for example, on MEMS devices, there's little microfluidic channels where different proteins can be analyzed and different molecules can be tested on you know, enzymes and things like that, and that's at the micro level. I'm wondering if on the nanoscale, little robots being injected into the body is a reality down the road. Is that in development? I know on the physical side, things like that are becoming more and more possible, but I'm wondering on the bio side where we might be at with all that.
That's a good question because of some of the novels that came by and actually even movies on robots being injected and then somehow tiny people come out of those and then start.
Exactly. It's tough finding the little people, right? You can make machines, but you just can't find the people to man them.
Yep. So those are the nano people coming out of the micron-sized robots and start taking cancer cells. And then, well, that is not true in terms of real people. You know, if people are really alarmed about these new technologies and then really robots somehow manipulating things, that is not true. But certainly there are really truly new technologies. For example, some micron science technologies. This work recently I have seen from MIT. If you inject a micron-sized particle, this is a specialized micron-sized particle, not nano. But then when it hits in the bloodstream, when it has certain pressure, for example, when you have plaque in the blood vessel, the pressure change differential makes these particles to fall apart and release enzymes. that dissolve the plaque. This is a very beautiful technology, very good example of the novelty in the technology. So, but then it is very sensitive to those slight differences. You talked about microfluidics and nanofluidics. So,
right.
You know, one of the problems whenever you make these you know, microfluidic devices is the pressure. And mm-hmm. and then so the slight change in that pressure at that site of action, if it delivers or if it disintegrates to release enzymes and things that get rid of plaque, you know, that is an amazing technology. So these are real in terms of robots, but not in a way that we think of bugs coming out of some kind of.
Right. No, that's great. Thanks very much.
I think we have a caller online. Person calling us in 212, please ask your question.
Yeah, hi. I was wondering, what is the most exciting or groundbreaking development in nanotechnology that you expect over the next 5 years?
That's a good question. In the next, I would say, 5 years, we would definitely see there are some very exciting targeted nanomedicines currently undergoing clinical trials. So I'm pretty sure some of those will be out in the market to benefit cancer patients worldwide. We will definitely have a few more tools for early detection of cancer, and these kits will become more affordable, I would say, between 5 to 10 years to benefit patients, especially in the developing countries. So what I mean by this is these are almost like kits that we use for sugar strips for diabetes. And then so they are in development, and especially for personalized medicine, I certainly foresee the personalized kits for example, therapy monitoring for cancer. And these will be coming out in the next, I would say, 5 to 10 year time frame.
We have the last couple of minutes left. Pat, would you like to add anything? Pat, are you?
Being included, and I learned a lot tonight, but I'm not sure I was able to contribute much.
Thank you. Sarthak, would you like to add something? We just have a couple of minutes left.
Oh, no. Thanks once again for having me, and thank you, Doctor, for your insights on nanotechnology. I think, you know, at the very least, it'll definitely be a field with enormous potential, and it really relies on leaders like yourself and, you know, enthusiasts around, you know, for the society to be able to make some of the translations, and I think it'll be a very exciting field to watch.
Thank you, Sarthak. Dr. Patri, it was great having you here. Pat, Kim, and Sarthak, it was a great discussion. And Gary, as always, you were wonderful. Thank you so very much. CureTrack thanks
all
its listeners and participants. Thank you all for your support, and we look forward to having all of you join us for the next Cure Panel Talk Show on Thursday to discuss yoga. For more details of upcoming shows, please visit trilex.com/curetalk. The link for today's broadcast will be sent to all panelists and participants and also made available on CureTalk within 24 hours. Thank you. Thank you, everyone. It's great having you here.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Patri.
Thank you, Gary.
Bye now.
And bye.
Thanks, Gary. Thanks, Bria.
Thanks,
Pat. Take care.